Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Yes, episode 591 of the Tennis Podcast. That's how much we love tennis, and it is Matt Informs Us International Podcast Day, which sounds very exciting, Matt. Well done on that research.
National or international?
Is it? Well, go on, Matt.
International Podcast Day. Shout out to listener Jim, who informed me of that.
Good work, Jim. Splendid work. And we've got an absolutely massive amount of tennis to talk about because, crikey, I couldn't keep up with the number of tournaments there were last week. But that's our job here on the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph. So fortunately, we've got Matt here as our backup. Basically, Catherine and I were going to, because we're in separate locations today. In fact, we're actually...
But we can all see one another.
We're talking on a video call, which is really weird. And it took at least 10 minutes for them to teach me how to prop up my phone in order to actually be seen on it. But that's what we've managed to do. And even though we're in separate locations, we are ready to go. Catherine and I were going to do this one-on-one. And then we realized there's too much tennis to keep up on our own. So here's Matt. Hello, Matt. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm very well. I hope I've seen enough tennis to be able to back you up.
Well, you better have now. So yeah, the pressure is on. Before we all start all that, what about our competition, which we opened last week and entries have been flooding in? If you are on our newsletter, you can enter our competition to win tickets, flight, accommodation to the Davis Cup by Rakuten Madrid finals between the 18th and the 24th of November to see round-robin matches of the team of your choice. There's still time to enter. It closes on October the 10th, so get yourself on our entry list, on our newsletter list.
And annoy David and Matt. On Monday, our WhatsApp group was buoyant with messages about what a great prize it is. Oh, I want to enter. What a great prize. What a great prize. I'm going to tell all my friends and family, what a great prize. And then suddenly, 24 hours later, after the competition launches, it's just a sea of complaints about the volume of entries that David and Matt are being alerted about via your email inbox settings, which I'm not troubled by. I've had a very serene
Catherine's
week.
Cleverly decided to avoid being part of this.
Yeah, I felt like I'd done the most sort of viral tweet of all time. My phone was going absolutely mad, but no, it was just entries into our competition. But no, yeah. It's good to see so many. And we have listeners from quite literally all around the world, which has been quite cool to see.
Who have we had entries from?
We've Islamabad. Had entries.
Yeah, we've had one entry from Islamabad. We've had, I've made a list, Canada, Brazil, Hungary, UK, US, Germany, Sweden, Ireland, Australia, Slovakia, Spain, France, Norway, New Zealand and Lebanon.
Blimey. So all of those people are, if they've got the answer right, and I tell you, some of them haven't, quite a few of them haven't. If you want to get yourself in with a chance of winning this incredible prize, a couple of tickets or to more than one
I think
match,
I got the answer wrong, actually.
You did
not,
get the
not
answer.
In my formal entry, but conversationally, yes, definitely got the answer wrong.
Both Matt and Catherine got the answer wrong to our podcast specific question that I invented. So they're not going to win. So that gives the rest of you a chance. And yeah, flights, accommodation, tickets, and you need to get on our newsletter list if you want to enter. So scroll down on your phone right now on your show notes and click on to sign up to our newsletter, which is full of good stuff in its own right. You can enter our prediction, or you can, no, you can't enter our predictions competition. You can see our weekly predictions. There's so many predictions going on at the moment that I
you
can't
can
keep
witness
up.
Other people that have foolishly entered into the predictions game.
Yes, which are the three of us. And we have Matt's stat every single week, not an alliteration. And we have lots of other stuff too.
How many people have emailed you this week to mansplain alliteration to you, David?
Yeah, I'm still struggling to get my head around it a little bit. But anyway, I'll get there. So that's
you've been
that's
flicking through the Urban Dictionary, hoping it will explain alliteration
to Urban you. Dictionary is amazing, isn't it?
Is there a hard copy of the Urban Dictionary available?
No, there isn't.
Oh, Christmas present, please. That's what I want. If you don't happen to win the competition, you can have our tennis podcast code to get 15% off, which is, just a second, you need to have the code TTP Davis Cup Finals. Go to the daviscupfinals.com website if you want to buy tickets and use our code and get 15% off. Right. Tennis stuff to talk about for this week. Let's begin with Wuhan, shall we? Which was the big WTA event, which has been won by Aryna Sabalenka for the second time in a row. She's never lost in Wuhan. 12 wins, 0 defeats. Her first 5 sets of the tournament, she lost 5 games. Oof. And then in her 6th set against Kiki Bertens, she was 5-1 up. She was a game away from beating Kiki Burton 6-1, 5-1, and needed one more game. And then she lost the next 6 games in a row. So that sort of stumped her little run, but she still went and won the title. What was fascinating was just how quick that surface was. I mean, I've heard this talked about before. I remember covering the event last time, but this year it really struck me, just watching the rallies and watching them with people who have played the sport at a high level, like Laura Robson and Kyotha Vong, people who really understand what it's like to be on these quicker services and what difference it makes. And it was so, I found it so refreshing to see tennis on a fast court.
Wuhanbledon, which doesn't really work, does it?
Oh, I don't know. Although I'm not really into plays on words, but you know, that one just, it just works because it actually is.
You're not into plays on words, but you think this is the exception to that.
Yeah, I like this one.
Matt, tiebreaker?
Yeah, it's not great, I don't think.
But it lives up to the name, doesn't it? Although Sabalenka's never really done anything at Wimbledon.
No, but the past winners, you had Venus, Kvitova, and then Alison Risk got to the final this week, and obviously she's a bit of a grass court specialist.
Well, she was fantastic. She beat, back-to-back, she beat Elena Svitolina, and then she beat Petra Kvitova, both of them in tidy fashion. I mean, she was comfortably the better player against Svitolina. I think she beat her 6-1, 6-3, and then she beat Kvitova 5-5. And what was notable from both of those two matches was that she had one of those absolutely epic games on the other player's serve, which I think Kvitova managed to hold on after 6 break points and half a dozen juices in 13 minutes. But there wasn't much of a left after that. You know, it took about 20 minutes for her to recover from that game. And Svitolina, the first game of the match was 14 minutes long, 10 juices, and she was broken on the 6th break point. And then it was 4 love with about 4 minutes later. You know, it's just Alison Risk, she's a slightly awkward-looking player. She doesn't look particularly dexterous in the way she hits the ball from the baseline, but it was metronomic in its consistency, and she's just such a strong mind, it seems, out there. 29 years of age, in the world's top 30 for the first time in her career. I think she's just a great story, one of these that flies under the radar, never really gets much in the way of headlines, but she was commendable.
She is total no-nonsense, isn't she, from a from a mental perspective, nonsense, of which more later, Andy Murray fans. Yeah, she's just, I mean, Sabalenka is no nonsense in terms of tennis, isn't she? It's just, I'm going to hit this ball, no other thoughts necessary. And Alison Risk is, I'm going to do my very, very best to win this point, no other thoughts necessary. She's just so dialed in at all times, but in a very sort of relatable way. Like, she is incredibly focused, but she just looks like she's sort of going about her day. Oh my God, there's a big exclamation mark for me, Matt, where David's face once was. Oh no, he's back. That was alarming.
I had the same thing. I was wondering whether to interject or not.
Literally, over the portion of the screen which your face until moments ago filled, there was just a huge exclamation mark, which I'm sure was some sort of, you know, allegory. She looks like she's just pottering about doing her shopping, except she's winning tennis matches. I love Alison Risk. I'm full of, I don't know, she's sort of brilliant in a very, very relatable way.
Yeah, you don't get anybody who says a bad word about her, really. Everybody seems to like her, respect her, I've never really thought that she's ever going to hurt anybody significant at the top end of the game. And then suddenly this year, remember when Ash Barty came into Wimbledon and she'd won the French Open, she'd won Birmingham on grass, and then she won the first three rounds of Wimbledon more straightforwardly than I can remember anybody winning in years. Everybody thought Ash Barty was going to win Wimbledon. I certainly did. And Alison Risk took her out and, you know, reached the quarterfinals of a Grand Slam for the first time in her career. And then she goes and she reaches the final of this event in Wuhan. Actually, it was the seventh time, I think, in nine finals that Risk has had in China. All of her successes have pretty much, apart from Sir Toganbosch, which she won this year, virtually everything has come in China, which is an interesting one. She just likes the conditions generally, I think, the vibe out there. And then her first 13 match victories ever in her career all came on grass, which just shows how suited she is to these fast conditions.
And it's a similar story with Sabalenka in China, I think, as well. I think I read that she's played nine tour events now in China, Sabalenka, and in eight of those she's reached at least the quarterfinals. So I think there is something to be said about the conditions in China suiting certain players, and they certainly seem to suit Sabalenka and Risk. Risk had some interesting comments about how, as much as anything, she thought the conditions are Wimbledon-like in terms of the balls that they use. She was saying, as much as the court is fast, the actual balls are kind of similar to the ones they use at Wimbledon. That seems to suit her. So I think it's just this time of year does seem to suit certain players better than others. I think we've talked a lot about how it really doesn't suit Sloane Stephens, but she's picked up a couple of wins, but never really done much at this time of year, where it seems to suit some players. So I'm always a bit hesitant to draw big conclusions about players at this time of the year, because the conditions are different and the draws are sometimes, you've got some players who aren't playing in them or they're fatigued from the whole season. But fair play to Risk and Sabalenka, who certainly played extremely, extremely well last week in Wuhan and were the best two players in the tournament.
You mentioned players that are happy at certain types of the year. I think the other thing is just how much energy they have to expend throughout the year. If you look at Ash Barty, who'd had this amazing first 6 months of the year, won Miami, won the French Open, reaches world number one. And I mean, she did okay. She got to the semi-finals in this one, but she looked absolutely exhausted.
David, you've literally gone sideways. This is a thrill ride.
No, I can't even see you. Oh, there you are. I can see you. Hello. Comedy gold here on the Tennis Podcast.
It's like being in a flight simulator with David.
So we've got this video call going on, folks. Some weird stuff's happening. I don't know whether I've had three
only
beers,
in your bit of
but
the
I
screen.
Haven't. You know, I didn't really know about my three beers, but I feel like I've had them. So anyway, Ash Barty suddenly looked absolutely exhausted, out on her feet in Wuhan. And that's the thing, isn't it? Some players come in and they're fresh because they... And I think that that was one of the things with Sabalenka. She's had such a tough year. If you think back a year ago when she won this title, we thought she was going to be the one, I would say, to follow Osaka. We were joking the other day that we'd got a field in our predictions for the year of the next person to do something. I can't remember what it was, and I just got Sabalenka next to it, and I was answering
Sabalenka next to everything.
No matter what anybody asked me, I just said Sabalenka. And it's she was kind of like last year's Andreescu before Sabalenka became uncool and started losing every match. And now Andreescu is everybody's answer to everything.
We still haven't seen her lose. She just won.
No. She won again today. Three sets against Alexandra Sasnovich in Beijing, which they've already started. What do you think, though, about Sabalenka? Because what does strike me, having seen what Andreescu's done, is that Andreescu has, obviously, I think, more options. But I don't know. I don't really understand why Sabalenka went so far off the boil, really.
No, I mean... Possibly the insane Instagram posts give us an insight into why. That's all I can think of. I mean, in a world where slightly bizarre Instagram posts are 10 a penny, that was award winning. But entirely normal activity on social media from Sabalenka this week. So the trend seems so that correlation. I'm reading into that correlation in the absence of any other sort of logic to where Sabalenka's form comes from, which I struggle for. She's such a sort of purple patch player, isn't she? That it's difficult to find rhyme or reason to it. So I'm looking to Instagram for the rhyme and reason. And it all was very nonsense free. I think there was just one like picture of her with that one trophy post saying, great week, thanks to my team. Mention of Tursunov, no weirdness, no stories about going to the hospital with random people. No weird emoji usage. It's all been hashtag normal. So
you're the one who introduced me to emoji usage, Catherine. So don't you start on other people, because I've now slightly lost the plot.
I think there should just be a quota of how many times you can use this. I've gone off mic because I'm having to use both my hands to simulate this emoji, and it is one of my very favourites. The hands shrugging, hands in the air, what on earth is happening in the world emoji. But I think if you're using it 8 times in one post, that should probably tell you something about your mental health.
You did give me a hard time for one emoji ridden comment that I made on WhatsApp earlier this week, because you couldn't decode what I meant.
Neither
could I.
Because you were trying to formulate a sentence using only emojis.
There's only three of them.
Yeah, there was one of them was a medal, though. I don't know what that meant.
Yeah, because I'm award winning. That's why.
This was in the predictions chat, wasn't it?
Mm.
Yeah, I had to mute that eventually.
Did you really?
Were we falling out?
I was getting
what
cross about
revelation.
The predictions. Yeah, sorry.
Matt has muted us.
Can you remember what specific stage you muted?
We were falling out, weren't we?
Yeah, I was asking questions and they weren't getting answered. And I thought...
Well, maybe they were and you just weren't aware of it because it was muted, Matt.
No, I'd waited hours. But there was no sensible information forthcoming. So I thought, oh. And then David started using emojis.
And then you just turned the whole thing off.
Right. Okay. I had a strop. Oh, God.
The other thing on my Wuhan list to bring this conversation back from where it's gone was the crowds, which
yes.
were fantastic in the last few days in Wuhan. And it was... I mean, look, it's still a pretty new event. It's 6 years old, first edition in 2014. And It was notable by its lack of spectators for most of the first 3 or 4 years, and it was put in. We've talked about this before, how it was brought to Wuhan because it's Lina's hometown, and she retired about 2 months before they started the first edition of it. Not ideal, but it was. I think I read that last year they'd improved the connections of the tram so that people could get there more easily from the city. And suddenly in the last 2 days of the tournament, you've got this 15,000 seat stadium absolutely jam-packed, and it was uplifting. But you know, when you compare it, see what's going on at the World Championships Athletics last night, where there were more runners in the 100 meters than there were spectators in the crowd. You know, it's so important that crowds are put at the head of what people do, because it might not make that much difference to your bottom line, but the experience, surely that's what sport's all about.
Yeah, I think it's okay for everyone to admit that crowds matter, and a big crowd and a great atmosphere makes it feel like it matters more, and mattering is what makes us watch that rather than, well, I suppose, and quality, but makes us tune in rather than watching two players slug it out down at the park. You know, you want to see stuff that matters. That's why we care about a World Cup match more than we care about a match of lesser import, whatever the sport, and a big crowd, thousands of people caring. It's about caring, isn't it? And seeing a bunch of other people caring right there in the moment makes you care. If ever you needed the contrast or the stark illustration of the alternate world, then unfortunately the Athletics World Championships in Doha at the moment is that, and it's frankly a disaster, isn't it? I mean, they predicted it might be a disaster. It seems like a disaster from the crowd perspective, and it feels like an insult to the athletes, and it's actually a really uncomfortable watch. So they've obviously worked really hard on it from a very hamstrung start in Wuhan. We've talked on previous podcasts around this time of year how much we feel for them as a tournament, but they've really acknowledged the significance of the issue rather than being defensive about it and sort of batting it away and all being arrogant about it and saying, if you build it, they will come. Well, no, maybe you've got to help them to come and encourage them to come and explain to them why they should come. And that's obviously all been done, and it's paid off, and that's great to see.
And it's great that a tennis event has that time to kind of blossom and bloom, whereas something like the one-off Athletics World Championships, which only happen every 4 years, this is their one go to have it in Doha, and it's just an absolute nightmare. Whereas at least Wuhan has addressed the problem and improved the transport links. And I think it's probably just acquired meaning for residents of that city. It's become something that they want to go to because they've seen good tennis played and they think, I want to be a part of that. And it's good that it has been given that time to grow, and hopefully it will just improve even more now.
Actually, I remember Courtney saying that a couple of years ago that there's not that much understanding necessarily or familiarity with the sport in that part of the world. They've been getting to know it, and that's shown by sometimes the way they react to what goes on the court. They attach just as much significance to doubles as they do to singles. And the other thing is they get really excited if anybody goes to the net.
Yes.
I mean, like, really vocal. Yeah. And start going wild as soon as somebody hits an approach shot. And the really funny thing was they had a kids' day early on in the tournament, and it was one of those kids' days where the place is packed with kids that the umpire is unwisely trying to shush and completely unsuccessfully. And every time a serve hit the net, they all cheered because they didn't know I can't exactly tell you why they did that, but it was very funny to watch.
They would love watching me play tennis.
Oh, well, and
you
talking
net
about
rusher, Matt.
No, but I hit the net a lot.
Oh, right, okay.
talking
in,
about
in
hacking
a different
down
sense of the phrase.
The park. This time next week, Matt and I will be hacking down the park, my local park, and Catherine will be the umpire.
Yeah, I wasn't invited to participate, which I can only take as an indication that David's running scared. So
I'm trying to have some... this is a match for the right to face you when you're fully fit after your back problem. And it's also a match for the right to coach you. I don't quite know how we got to that. But Matt and I had an argument about who should be your coach.
It was a listener email. Someone said who would each of you pick as the other one to coach you? And Catherine immediately said David.
No, that is absolutely unequivocally not true. Don't make me mute you, Matt. That is not true. I said, from a purely tennis perspective, Matt, 100% Matt. I said, if I just needed motivation or someone to snap me out of a sort of... what player can I pick as a Simona Halep? Esque self-flagellation funk, then I would pick Upbeat Law.
I'm your Darren Cahill.
Although I could imagine you doing a Cahill and just saying, right, sort it out then, it's up to you.
I'll see you later.
And that would, I would not respond in a Halep-esque way to that. I would probably default. Protest.
I think hang on. That's harsh.
So the winner of me against David is then for the rematch will be coached by Catherine.
No.
So I'm the prize.
That's right. Yeah. You're going to coach. Yeah, you're going to coach the loser of next week's match for the rematch between me and Matt.
Right. Yeah. So who would you two pick? Who would you two pick to coach you?
Oh dear, I need a week to think about that.
Catherine. Yeah.
What? Just to be clear, the winner of the match gets to play Matthew Whittaker, Catherine's brother.
Who's just sort of done an 1800s Wimbledon and just sailed through to the final without lifting a finger.
Oh. And who's also really good, I understand. So,
yeah, so
he's definitely better than a lot of us, I reckon, yeah.
Okay, right. Okay, so anyway, that's the latest.
But I do know his
weaknesses,
so I'd be a good coach.
Okay, so well, I get the winner of our match gets to have you coach us against your brother.
Right, so. But I'm in the chair, so I could do a Leani if I wanted to. You're better than this, David. I want to help you.
You're coaching next week's match. Anyway, you don't want to hear about this, folks, dear. That's another 4 minutes gone. Zhuhai, which has also taken place this week, and Andy Murray has had some encouraging matches, hasn't he? I mean, he beat Tennis Sangren in a rematch of their one from a few weeks ago in America, and then he narrowly lost out to Alex de Minaur. I mean, what did you think seeing Andy Murray playing in that sort of form?
Whiskers away from beating the eventual champion. I'm trying to temper my excitement and enthusiasm, because in all honesty, these two matches is the first time that I've felt like a genuine believer. I'm not convinced that he can make it all the way back, but it was the first time I thought there was some evidence to suggest it might be possible. Because he was winning Andy Murray-esque points. That's what was so uplifting about it. He wasn't winning a different way, as so many people, us included, have speculated that he might have to over the last couple of years, find different ways of winning points because his old way of winning points was so labour intensive. He was winning vintage Andy Murray points that he had absolutely no right to win. And Alex de Minaur was brilliant and looked fresh as a daisy at the end of that second round match with Murray. Absolutely just outrageously fresh, given they were playing in about 400 degrees, 80% humidity. It was about a 3-hour-long, grueling match. And Murray was bent double, leaning on his racket, gasping for air. And that's not, it's not because he hasn't put the work in, it's because there's just no way to replicate those sorts of matches. The only way to get fit for them is to play them. But it must have felt horrible for him to be losing
because he didn't have the physical stamina. And looking up the other end of the court and seeing a 20-year-old that looked like he could go for days. It was depressing.
I don't think Andy Murray will have been disheartened this time.
No.
At all.
But it would have been... He wouldn't have enjoyed that feeling.
Mm, yeah. No, I know what you mean, but I think that the fact is his game was there and he was only short by a little bit in terms of the physicality, and he's doing what he said he was hoping that this four-week stretch would do. Now, admittedly, that's only week one. He's drawn Matteo Berrettini in the first round in Beijing, and then he goes on to Shanghai, doesn't he? And then I think he's got Antwerp in Europe the week after that. I mean, he may well not play all four of those weeks. Depends on how many match wins he gets, how tired he is, how he physically pulls up from these matches. But he won a match, and then he had a really hard-fought second match. And I think that that is exactly what he requires in order to incrementally get back to something like full fitness for the Australian Open. And really, that's what this is all about, isn't it?
And he pushed de Minaur as hard as anyone in that tournament. And he said after the match against Tennis Sangrin, which in itself was a good win and a good kind of indicator of how much progress he's made in the last month, because, of course, he lost to Tennis Sangrin in Winston-Salem about a month ago, and this time he beat him. And other than a slight sort of dip in the second set tiebreak where he could have closed out in straight sets, he played a really good match, I thought, there, Murray. But he said after that match that he was feeling ready to go again, ready to play another match, which was absolutely not what he was feeling at the start of the year before his surgery. He could kind of manage one match, but he was then the next day waking up in all sorts of pain and just not wanting to play again. Whereas now his body feels good enough that he's able to keep playing these matches. Obviously, he's only played two back-to-back, so it'll be interesting to see over these next few weeks whether he can stretch that to three with getting a couple of wins. But generally, it was just so uplifting and encouraging, I thought, to see him back. And even seeing the pictures of him sort of mingling with everyone in Beijing, like, he's part of the tour again, and that in itself is just really nice to see.
Seeing him prowling around the back of the court, whinging about nonsense, whinging about unspecified nonsense, was just great.
I didn't realise how much I needed that.
Yeah. I hate nonsense too, Andy.
He came up to the umpire at one stage, who was, I think, Cecilia Alberti, or I think it was her, and he came down and he sat down and he complained about an overall. She gave him an answer. Well, this was at the sit down, and he just goes, "Yeah, but what about that one earlier on his side?" You know? I thought, "Yeah, here we go, lawyer like Andy Murray again."
Didn't spot that, did you?
So Alex de Minaur has won his third title of the year. Crikey, that's good. What were the other ones? I can't even remember them.
Well, he won Sydney at the start of the year, didn't he? I couldn't remember what the second one was. And Sydney was interesting because, remember, he won that Sydney title on the Saturday and then they gave him a Monday first rounder at the Australian Open.
Oh, right.
Which was a really, really tough gig, and there was a lot of chat about that at the time. What was the other? When was his other title?
It was Atlanta, just after Wimbledon.
When he
sort of served his way to the title, like he didn't face a break point or something mad like that. And I think that is one of the really big improvements I've seen in de Minaur's game. His serve, he's getting so many free points on it. It's kind of, he's a bit Nishikori like his game in that his number one attribute is probably his speed and his movement and his ability to kind of take the ball early and be consistent. But if there's a point of difference with Nishikori, I think it's the fact that his serve is better than Nishikori's, and that, to me, I think will stand him in quite good stead going forward for de Minaur. I'm really impressed with him at the moment. I think he had a groin injury in the year and struggled a bit to come back from that, but since Wimbledon he's been not the form player, because obviously there have been players, one in particular, tearing it up more than him. But he's sort of quietly been really impressive since Wimbledon. Now he's got two titles since Wimbledon.
Mm. And you can see it. You can see how frustrated Andy Murray was at times, hitting shots that he would have assumed would be winners against most players. I think that's what de Minaur has over just about everybody is speed that doesn't seem possible at times across the court. So it'll be interesting.
I think that makes him really exciting to watch. I think speed is sort of such a primitive part of sport, really. People have measured speed for ages, and to see someone with his speed on a tennis court and how he's able to use that as a weapon, I just think makes him really exciting. He reaches balls that you think, how's he going to get that? And then he hits a winner.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Pablo Carreño Busta has won the title in Chengdu. When was the last time we mentioned Pablo Carreño Busta on the podcast? That's a while ago, isn't it?
2 years, I would expect. Yeah.
The people have been waiting.
well done him. He beat Alexander Bublik, who was kind of the story of the tournament, really.
He manages to make himself the story wherever he goes, Bublik, and that's his MO.
That's his goal.
He needs to become a thing.
Yeah.
Because he's against good to watch.
Dimitrov, I've watched this match against Dimitrov, who was playing well, and there's no way the guy could lose. No way. He's a set up. It's 3-all second
set.
Why
would you ever say that about Grigor Dimitrov?
Because I'm a fool. And it's 3-all second set. Bublik's having treatment to his knee at a set and 3-all, right? Dimitrov's playing beautifully. Bublik hits 35 aces and 15 double faults over the course of this match. That's 50 points that Dimitrov has no role to play in whatsoever. And then Dimitrov loses the second set 11-9 on a tiebreak, and the third set on a tiebreak as well. So Bublik gets all the way to the final.
He's all the things, isn't he, Bublik?
He
doesn't mind a bit of trash talk. Do you remember when he drew Andy Murray in the first round of Wimbledon and decided to give him some sort of boxing-esque trash talk and then lost sort of 2-1 and 2 or something?
Yeah.
And he loves an underarm serve. He underarm serves more than Kyrgios does.
He is the challenger Kyrgios, isn't he? He's somebody who hasn't made it yet, but he's starting to make it. That's the thing. He's starting to do stuff now.
Mm. He's just overtaken Kukushkin as the Kazakh number one, I saw.
Hotly contested title.
Absolutely. And what you were saying about the underarm serve, there was a rally played against Fritz where, honestly, the underarm serve was the least outlandish and outrageous shot in the rally. there were hot dogs, lobs, everything going on. It was great.
Awesome. Shapovalov got to the semis, and in classic style now, he lost in the semis. He's 0-7, I'm reading from your notes here, Matt.
Yeah, 0-7 in ATP semifinals. And whoever has beaten him has gone on to win the title every time. And
there you go.
That stood again with Carreño Busta.
It's not great for him, is it? When moments ago we were talking about Alex de Minaur winning a third title of the year, Shapovalov yet to get past a semifinal stage at any event is a disappointing record. I'm still optimistic generally about Eugenie and him turning things around a bit, but that record's going to get in his head if it hasn't already.
Well, it still makes you feel like his game is more about the spectacular than the successful. And it felt like he'd made a real stride at the US Open. We talked about the match against Monfils, the impact of Eugenie, all the rest of it. But yeah, he's got to start turning ATP 250 events. There, you said it yourself, three titles for de Minaur this year at that sort of level. You should be able to do that as your first layer of success and then move on from there. That's what these players do. And he's yet to do that. So still a long way to go for him. a title also in Tashkent for Alison Vanuitvank, and we talked about crowds. I mean, they were playing on courts that looked like the ones you and me will be on next year, next week, Matt. I'm telling you. And Henley and Arden is not hosting a WTA international tournament anytime soon, as far as I'm aware.
Well, nor is Tashkent. I believe that was the final edition of it.
Oh, it's gone out with a bang.
Well, maybe Henley's taken over. anyway, so she beat Sorana Kostea in the final.
Well, top seed and US Open doubles semi-finalist Victoria Kuzmova went out in the quarterfinals.
That is a Laver Cup-esque intro, Matt.
I know, I just needed to get it in.
By the way, Sabalenka, I think, won singles and doubles in Wuhan. She is one heck of a doubles player, playing with Elise Mertens, and that seems to be doing her a lot of good. So this week it's Beijing, which is a premier mandatory tournament. I mean, what sort of name is that?
But I believe those names are changing next year.
Well, I do hope so.
I'm not sure if that's confirmed, but I mean, it's a no-brainer.
Not exactly a sizzling
name, if anyone out there from the WTA is thinking of changing them, yes, do it.
Change them to something good. But anyway, there's loads of points and prize money available for it. Everybody's pretty much there, apart from Serena Williams. She's not entered. And Tokyo's going on at the same time. It's men and women, Beijing, isn't it? And then
it's a 500 for the men and a premier mandatory for the women.
So which there are four of those. And
Djokovic has been doing some sumo wrestling.
In Tokyo? I saw that.
Yeah.
Some sparring with the sumo
wrestling. It's not quite the physique for it.
Nope.
On the basis of these photos, but
it was quite amusing to see him try to move the sumo wrestler even an inch, and he wasn't able to do it with all his might.
Yeah, he's quite a big lad. Wonder what sort of tennis player he'd make.
Sumo wrestler. There's the sumo wrestler, an underdressed one, I would say.
Do you think he's better at tennis, or Djokovic is better at sumo wrestling?
At Tennis Podcast, pole vault. Coming your way.
I think sumo wrestling, from what I've seen, is largely about physique. I'd say. I mean, I'm not saying there's not skill involved.
Catherine analysis.
But I would say that the number one determining factor of whether you'll be a successful sumo wrestler is your physique.
We're going to get emails about this from sumo fans who are going to disprove this.
Whereas with tennis, I mean, physique is it's a thing, but there's more other stuff going on.
Okay.
That some sumo wrestlers might just be great at. But you can't do it in a nappy, so.
No. Okay. I'm not quite sure where to go with that. What else is on my list?
Who's the top seed in Tokyo? Well, Djokovic. Who else is playing Tokyo?
Čurić is there, I think. I think he's the second seed.
Has Djokovic ever played Tokyo before? Doesn't he usually play Beijing?
I think he's played both, hasn't he?
Well, he's specifically said he's playing Tokyo this year so that he can get used to the courts for the Olympics next year.
Oh. That's smart. Good plan, because it's the same venue, isn't it?
It's obviously slightly different time of year, but in terms of the court conditions, I think he announced around Wimbledon that he was going to be playing Tokyo. So it's been something that he's obviously been thinking about for a while.
Whereas Federer is claiming that he's still undecided about whether he'll play the Olympics, which I find so ludicrous.
Yeah, I don't believe that.
No, it's just simply not true.
Maybe he's just he does try to say everything is about how I am physically, doesn't it? Depending on, you know, he might be injured, I suppose. But
yeah, but he doesn't say I'm undecided whether I'm playing Wimbledon next year because I don't know whether I'll be injured.
I read those quotes and I wondered whether I don't know what language he gave them in. I read them in English and I did wonder whether what he meant was I'm undecided about whether to play doubles as well at the Olympics, because that might, obviously he's already got a doubles medal. Mixed would be an option with Bencic.
Or he might be
really focusing on the singles. I'm not sure, but I can't believe he's not going to play anything.
Mm.
Federer, Bencic mixed. Yes, please.
Incidentally, in Beijing, they've already had a 2:30 a.m. match finish between Garbiñe Muguruza and Sofia Kenin. Match went on the court just after 1 in the morning. I mean, they had had about 5 epics, finishing 7-6 in the third. But what I just think something needs to be changed so that those players can come back the next day and play it at a normal time and not lose out massively.
Muguruza is a witching hour tennis specialist, isn't she? Poor thing.
Yeah. Not 2:30, not even her latest finish of the year. No. I mean, how ridiculous is tennis sometimes?
Matt, here's your stat for the newsletter. Matt does this stat every week. Yours can be Muguruza moved to 1-1 for matches that finished after 2 a.m.
Yeah.
For the year.
Not a bad record.
Yeah.
So that pretty much concludes the tennis on court for last week and this week. The other talking points have been off the court. One of them is I think this news has probably been out there for a bit about the exhibitions that Federer and Zverev are going to play the week of the Davis Cup finals. Now, Zverev told us at the O2 last year, Matt and I both attended the press conference in which he explained why he's not going to play Davis Cup finals this year, because of the length of the season and the inability to have a decent off season. He has said separately that he doesn't like the format changes, and you know, a number of people feel like that. I know a lot of fans really hate the fact that they're going to lose the home and away throughout the year, and that's gone from the sport. There's a number of people within the sport who don't think that this format is going to work. There are others that do. But Zverev has chosen that week, upon the invitation, I would imagine, of Roger Federer. Obviously, they're now represented by the same agency teammate, to go, I think it's to... It turns out now, I think it's 4 separate exhibitions that week in different parts of the world. I think one's in Chile, one's in Mexico. Can't remember where the other couple are. My immediate reaction to that was one of, frankly, disappointment. Not... It's up to them what they do, and obviously Switzerland haven't qualified for the Davis Cup final, so they wouldn't be playing in it anyway. But for Zverev, I thought it was, I don't think it's a great look, to be honest, to the same week that you've said you know it's too late in the year to play the Davis Cup finals and you need your off season, to be going off and playing 4 exhibitions around the world. Now, some people say, have responded to me and said, look, exhibitions are not the same as competitive match play over the space of 8 days, which is certainly true, but
it's also not the same as holiday or a training block.
No,
it precludes you doing either of those things.
What are your thoughts generally?
I mean, I'm sure Zverev will have some sort of mealy-mouthed explanation along those lines of you know, exhibitions not being the same as match play, etc. But it weakens what is a very valid argument in principle from Zverev. I think the season is too long, etc. There are legitimate reasons to be concerned over the Davis Cup format. I personally still don't think that's a reason to boycott it, or certainly wouldn't be for me. But it's legit to have concerns about it. It's legit to not be happy with the length of the season. I don't think this is a particularly dignified or grown-up way of handling it. Just looks, maybe not dignified or grown-up, it looks a bit graceless, I think. And, you know, ultimately, you can talk around it all you like. We know the primary motivation, that there will be other factors, you know, bringing tennis to those parts of the world that don't have huge events. That's a really good thing. Audience, etc. But we know the primary motivation for players playing those exhibitions is money. We know that. So bottom line, you're choosing money over representing your country, is how I see it. Those are the two biggest factors at play, and that's a real shame. It's a real shame, and it is not in the interests of tennis. Ultimately, I don't think, as much as there are positive upshoots that I just mentioned to them going and playing in that part of the world, they're not as big as a strong, unified Davis Cup that people, in spite of their concerns, try and get behind, or at least give a go. It bothers me that everyone's writing it off without giving it a go.
If he was to say, well, hold on, look, I just think that this is a massive mistake. I played the Davis Cup home tie to get my country to it in, what was it, April, but I just don't believe in the Davis Cup finals, and I'm going to show my displeasure by boycotting it. And yes, I am going to slightly troll it by playing a bunch of exhibitions.
I'd have a lot more respect for that. That openness, rather than
I've no idea if he does feel like that at all. I mean, I would still
counter with, why not give it a go? Because we don't know what it's going to be like. I would still counter with that, and I would still find it a shame that he felt that way. But I would have some respect for that position, certainly.
What do you think, Matt?
Well, I agree. I just think by playing these exhibition matches, he's undermining his own argument, which I think is a very legitimate argument about wanting more time off, number one, and also more time to train. The point he was making in that press conference he gave that we attended last year, David, was that tennis players don't actually get that much time to kind of work on their game during the season, and you need that time during the off season. By playing an exhibition, he's making his off season shorter. And, you know, if there is a player whose game has kind of stagnated over the past 12 months and could do with a good training block over the off season, Zverev would be up there. Now, I'm sure he'll say that he'll get some sort of advice from Federer in these exhibitions, and playing with him is never a bad thing, that kind of thing. Kind of get that argument, but at the same time, what he said before is that he wants these longer training blocks, and to then play an exhibition, whatever two ways, you know, whatever way you look at it, is a contradictory thing to do based on what he said in the past. So I find that the main disappointment out of it all, because we like the fact that he's honest and upfront and gives his thoughts on the length of the season, but he's not backing those thoughts up with this action, I don't think.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what he does say when asked about it. I should say as well, I had a couple of people say to me, well, you know, you would say this because you are from the tennis podcast that is now sponsored by the Davis Cup finals between now and the Madrid finals in a month or so's time. Which, you know, hands up, I can't completely say to you, oh, well, that's nothing to do with anything at all, because we are sponsored by the Davis Cup finals between now and then. I can say, hand on heart, that isn't the reason why I have this view. I've been consistent on this show over the last few years that I felt that Davis Cup needed to be reformed, and that, to me, a finals makes sense. And you can go back and listen to the archives to hear that conversation point several times over when we weren't having any sponsorship at all. The fact is, I still don't know whether it'll work. Until it happens, we don't know whether it'll work. But that has always struck me as something that needs to happen in order to try to get the best possible event. I mean, it clearly isn't in the best week in the world. They've acknowledged that themselves. And it's just a shame, again, that they haven't found tennis as a whole come together and found a week that works for way more people. And once again, it makes me feel slight. I'd love to talk to Federer about this as well, and hear his views on it, because he has taken a week in the calendar for the Laver Cup, which was a fantastic few days of tennis. We talked about it last week. There's so much good about it, but that could have been a week for the Davis Cup finals. And he's now, yes, he's not playing the event. I think he gets more of a pass than Zverev does, because frankly, his nation isn't in it for a start, but also Federer has had 20 years, he's played the Davis Cup, he's won the Davis Cup. Zverev is not in the same position as he is in, but it does rankle that these exhibitions are being held at exactly the same time as this massive team competition. And I think it may be that they just have to book these locations so far in advance and commit to them maybe even before they knew the date of the Davis Cup finals. Maybe it would have made no difference anyway. But why isn't it the week after? It just feels like it just grates. It
feels like a troll.
It does. It grates with me that is happening. And it comes more to the point of just, again, tennis fighting itself, all the significant constituents within it, and Roger Federer is a massive one of those. He has now become one of the factions within tennis that is just battling it out for territory. That doesn't feel good for tennis overall. As much as the many, many good things that he brings, the sooner the sport and its factions come together and just try to figure out a way to make all this work for the betterment of the sport, well, that's what I want.
Doesn't feel imminent, does it?
No, it doesn't. So, look, you know, I take on the chin that we wrestle all the time with things that we should say yes to and say no to in terms of opportunities for whether it's sponsorship and so forth. We are really, we do try to be vigilant about it and not compromise ourselves. But what we do make sure we do is anybody we do partner with, we tell them, look, we're going to give our honest opinions about things regardless of who we're sponsored by. That's just the way we do it. And people can take it or leave it. And that's what we've done on this occasion. Nick Kyrgios has been finally adjudicated upon his behaviour in, what was it, Cincinnati, where he had the argument with Fergus Murphy and several other things that he did over the course of that period. He's ended up getting, and this came out, I think the day after or 2 days after Laver Cup finished, judgment, and also a few hours or a day after Kyrgios had said himself, my shoulder's injured. He played a match. He lost, I think, 7-6, 6-1. And he said, my shoulder hurts. I'm likely not going to play for a while. He then announced that he's calling his season to a halt, apart from trying to play the Davis Cup finals for Australia in mid-November. The ATP judgment then came out to say that he was getting a fine of $25,000. This is in addition to all the fines he got during the event or straight afterwards, and a suspension of 16 ATP weeks. However, that is a probationary period of 6 months. So that 16-week ban will only come into operation if he were to fall foul of the rules once more in the period of 6 months to which he's been given this probation. And what he's got to try and avoid in that period is any verbal or physical abuse of officials, spectators, or any other persons while on court, unsportsmanlike conduct based upon an act such as spitting directed towards an official, spectator, or other person during or upon the conclusion of a match, any visible obscenity directed towards an official. 6 months he's got to keep this up for. And he's got to have continued support from a mental coach while competing at ATP Tour events, and additional support to be sought during the off-season in November and December from a professional specialising in behavioural management.
Do you think applications are flooding in from mental coaches and specialists in behavioural management? I want that job.
I think so. It's a bit like football managers who go to Manchester United and think, I want to be the one to turn them around.
Yeah, right.
What do you think of the judgment?
Oh, I think the timing of it is laughable. And I think I wait eagerly to see if it'll be held to, and because he is not going to go 6 months without swearing during a tennis match audibly. And that is what those rules state, that if he commits an audible obscenity, he will receive a ban from the sport, correct?
Obscenity and verbal or physical abuse and unsportsmanlike conduct.
So audible obscenity isn't in there.
No, it doesn't.
No, that's interesting. Right. Okay.
they probably know he won't get away with that one. But the only thing is, I mean, he got this come down to him the end of September. So that's October, November, December. The only event he's likely to play in that period is Davis Cup. And then you're talking January, February, March. So the Australian summer and Indian Wells, Miami.
Well, the other factor to consider, and you could say this is just part of the job, but it makes umpiring Nick Kyrgios matches now even more difficult.
Because
if you give him a formal warning, that is getting him banned from the sport. And I'm not saying any pressure will be applied, but you know, umpires will be aware of the various stakeholders in those turns of events, right? You know, there'll be people desperate for that not to happen. Probably more desperate than Nick Kyrgios himself for that not to happen. So it makes an already incredibly tough gig of umpiring Nick Kyrgios matches now even tougher, which is just an interesting sort of upshot of the whole thing. It just feels like, have they explained why it's taken so long?
Why is there
no onus on them to explain why it's taken so long and what the process has been?
Richard Ings, who used to run the rules and regs on the ATP and is a bit of an authority on this subject, anytime something like this comes up, he's the person everybody goes to for comment. He felt it was all absolutely fair. You know, they take as long as they take. I mean, it still does feel like this massive coincidence that it happens to have fallen just after the Laver Cup and just after he's announced that he can't play for 2 months or whatever. But at the same time, I could also imagine that maybe they were just going to get to it eventually, and then suddenly all this stuff happened in terms of Kyrgios saying he's going to pull the cord on his year, and they thought, right, we better put this out.
But it's as important as justice being seen to be done is as important as justice being done. So even if there are no sinister or cynical motivations for the timing of this announcement and decision, nonetheless, they should have been aware of how it would look, of how these timings would look, and it doesn't look good.
No, it doesn't. So anyway,
Matt,
we'll see what happens. What do you think, Matt?
Well, I mean, I was kind of unsure what an appropriate punishment would be. I felt very strongly that there needed to be something. I know Chris Clary came on the podcast and said that he absolutely thought he should be slapped with quite a big suspension, and he hasn't got that. So I find it quite difficult to actually comment on what the actual punishment is. I'm interested to see how Kyrgios will take it, because I was looking back at the one he got at the end of 2016 when he tanked that match in Shanghai, and then he got given a fine and an 8-week suspension, and he did come back 2017 very briefly a slightly reformed character. It didn't last long, but his attitude on court was a lot better at the start of 2017. I remember that was the period where he had those really good matches in Indian Wells and Miami.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
But I noticed at the time then, so in 2016, once he got hit with the suspension, he put out a statement saying that he was sorry and that he respected the decision and he wanted to improve. This time, I've not seen any signs of contrition or remorse or anything. I mean, he was kind of joking about it a little bit on Instagram, wasn't he? I don't get the sense that he quite understands the severity of the way he spoke to Fergus Murphy in Cincinnati. So, you know, we'll be able to judge properly when he's back on a tennis court, but I've not been overly encouraged by what I've seen from him on Instagram, kind of joking about it when it's not really something to joke about.
Mm. Enter the mental coach. Get your applications in now.
We will see what that leads to. Okay, right. Well, that's the tennis. That's the off-court stuff. I should say we're looking, if anybody's got any bright ideas, we're looking for a live event venue in London in the first 2 weeks of December. To
Wembley Stadium was unavailable, so yeah, we're on the hunt.
And it wouldn't have been big enough anyway. this is for Tennis Podcast Live, folks, who it's not an open entry. We're hoping to do those eventually. But this is for people who have backed us to a certain level in our crowdfunding of last year. We'll be running the same thing again in December. But yeah, if you've got any great ideas of where might make a good live venue, we're open for ideas and suggestions. For, I don't know, we'd probably be about 50 people, won't we?
Hyde Park,
yeah.
It's a bit unseasonal, though.
Let us know. Tennispodcast.net and our contact form is on there. You can email us. You can tweet us at tennispodcast, whatever you want to do. We brought you in association with The Telegraph. We have our mascot, Rio, with a Y. We're executive produced by tennisballs.com. We've got our road trip next week, Catherine. Matt, you come into Solihull. How cool.
We are. I've never been.
If you've got your passport.
You've not been before.
No. It takes an awful long time to get there from where I live. I'm having to go up a day early, aren't
I? It's quicker to get to Paris, I think, than it is to get to Birmingham.
You do need a visa as well. So make sure you
Roll on HS2.
Well, Catherine and I have got a little road trip tomorrow.
Have you?
Yeah.
What's going on?
We're going to the Ding.
The what?
It's that's a nickname for Reading that my friends and I try to make take off.
That wasn't the reaction you were hoping for then.
So this is Reading against Fulham, yeah. Catherine and Matt's teams. So, I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen football matches involving your teams with you before. Am I to expect that I may only have the company of one of you next week because relations may be somewhat frosty?
Well, Matt is being the bigger man and sitting with me in the home stand.
Mm. Right. So if Fulham score, I need to be on my best behaviour so not to get punched. Yeah.
Crikey. It's tense.
It is a bit tense, actually.
I suspect that is a problem you might have, Matt. So if I were you, I would develop some sort of strategy for that because that's what my money's on.
Okay, well, I'll get an update on this next week. If they turn up to Solihull, we're not only having our podcast up here, we're having our tennis match, me against Matt, and all the ramifications of that, winner to get Catherine's coaching in the future. I can't exactly remember what it was anymore now. But anyway.
Have you decided yet who would be your coach?
I need a week. I told you. Yeah, I need a week.
Have we decided the format of this match?
Yeah, it's best of three. Best of three with a champions tiebreak for the third set. Laver Cup rules.
I have to sit and umpire a whole best of three.
Yes.
And bring my iPad.
and it's not even like proper tennis. It's us. So, crikey. Anyway, so that's happening next week. And then we're going down the pub to talk about stuff for next year. Awesome. So yes, you've been listening to the Tennis Podcast. Thank you for your company. If you would like to get on the newsletter and enter the Davis Cup Finals competition, do so. Scroll down on your phone right now, click to sign up to our newsletter, which will be going out in the next couple of days. 10th of October is the deadline. And yeah, we will be back with you again next week. Tell your friends about the Tennis Podcast. Make sure they start listening as well. And we'll speak to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.